The Guardian.
Last year, stories surfaced of an extraordinary phenomenon that has scientists baffled. Between 2016 and 2017, a number of US diplomats in Cuba reported experiencing distressing symptoms. Many claim to have heard curious, sometimes piercing sounds, either at their residences or in hotel rooms in Havana. The claims were followed by reports of inexplicable afflictions, and the inexplicable, of course, soon made way for speculation.
After American diplomats suffered from a variety of physical ailments, U.S. officials are reportedly looking into whether the symptoms were caused by a possible type of acoustics device that was either outside the homes of embassy workers or inside, provided by the Cuban government.
The leading theory right now for the U.S. State Department sounds like something out of a spy film from a bygone era.
This is the realm of James Bond, to be able to have an acoustical device and you can point it at a building and to be able to specifically target an individual is virtually impossible.
And last week, the preliminary study of those diplomats was released by researchers, prompting further debate around what happened.
Bit by bit, it became to emerge that while they initially complained about hearing issues or being exposed to a large sound, that there was much more going on with these individuals.
But with no unifying explanation, we ask scientists on both sides of the border what they think happened. I'm Ian Sample. This is Science Weekly.
Hello, is that Doug?
This is.
Hi, Doug, it's Max Sanders.
Douglas Smith was part of the team examining the US diplomats that were in Havana. He's also one of the co-authors of the study just released in the Journal of the American Medical Association. He walked me through the reason for the study and the situation that brought his team to the research. Douglas, tell us about these people that you studied. Who are they and why were you assessing them?
So these were U.S. government workers, and they had previously been assessed both at their station in Havana, Cuba, and then also in Florida at the University of Miami. And bit by bit, it became to emerge that while they initially complained about hearing issues or being exposed to a large sound, that there was much more going on with these individuals. So their initial evaluation was more ear, nose, and throat type of exams. But subsequently, it became clear that they were having something that looked akin to persistent concussion.
What were the kinds of things that they reported happening while they were in Havana?
Well, almost all of them reported hearing a sound, not all, but almost all. And the type of sound this was varied according to individuals. Some heard high-pitched noise, sometimes described as cicada-ish, but more metallic. Some described kind of heavy scraping of machinery. Others reported kind of like the baffling sound that you have if you're driving a car and a back window is open. There was a range of audible phenomena that were reported, but all had this initial strange or mysterious experience with audible sound.
So where do you start with an investigation like this? What do you look at?
You know, the problem before was that they were seeing their own private physicians and all kinds of places getting all kinds of different tests. So the goal was to have a capability of comparing apples with apples. So have everyone come here, see a series of experts who examined various neurological issues, and, you know, come to a conclusion or, you know, see if there's a consensus amongst these experts about what their findings tell us.
So what did you find?
Well, we found what was hinted at before, that this absolutely looks like persistent concussion. The problem is it's concussion without a concussion. That means without a history of head trauma. They had problems with concentration, how quickly they think, processing speed. Their balance was off in many cases. Their vision was off. They couldn't, you know, focus on objects as well as they should. So these are very common findings we see in persistent concussion patients who come to our concussion clinics. And here's a problem. The term concussion is actually not a true diagnosis because the word is more akin to the word consumption as it was used long ago to describe another mysterious syndrome. So the word concussion only describes symptoms. The underlying causes are not taught. But we do believe it's dysfunction of the brain's network. So the fibers that run throughout the brain, called axons, that travel through the white matter, are selectively vulnerable to the, we call it the rotational acceleration forces, like when you get a head impact. In the case of these folks working in Havana, they didn't have that history of impact, but had the same constellation of symptoms that appeared like the brain's network was dysfunctional.
As Douglas explained, we normally associate concussions with physical trauma. But what was it in this instance?
That is the key question. So we do not think that the audible phenomenon caused any kind of injury to the brain, because that's not known to happen. We think that audible phenomenon was more of a side effect of something else, like a machine going on or off could create noise that might have been heard, for example. It could have been coincidental for another reason that we don't know about. So concussion is a mechanical injury. The blow to a head, or even you don't even have to hit your head. It could be a high-speed car crash where your head is just rapidly rotated, and that also can cause concussion. That doesn't mean that in these cases that it wasn't some form of mechanical disruption of the brain network. It's just not from a direct, rapid blow to the head.
And is there anything in the literature, though, that sort of points to another kind of stimulus, another kind of thing that could produce that effect?
Well, unfortunately, there are several things that have been studied in the past, and that would be looking at other types of what they might call directed energy, things like infrasound, that's below where a human can hear, and ultrasound, above and way above where a human can hear, and microwaves. All have been used in experimental models, and all have shown that they can cause damage to the brain.
And damage like this that you see?
Well, the problem is that we don't have the brains to examine, so we have only kind of inferential evidence of what's going on with the brain network. In fact, our just normal, we call it conventional neuroimaging, did not show anything of great interest.
It seems, though, that these patients might have a different progression in their symptoms, and I'm wondering if that differs to what you see in a regular concussion.
Yeah, there's a couple of important points about that. One is, it's not exactly clear, and we're working off of the patient's historical account of the development of their symptoms. In concussion, the moment after the head impact or the insult is where you're going to have the peak of the greatest manifestations of the concussion symptoms. And then they may either just be stable, which is not typically the case, or they resolve over time. In this cohort from Havana, it appears that some individuals are describing symptoms that evolved, that became worse over time. That's a very curious finding. The other thing that might be different, and this is all speculation because we don't have a good statistics or really epidemiology, is that in concussion, at least 80% of individuals have a very rapid recovery. So you've been exposed to a head blow, you've dazed and confused, maybe even lost consciousness. But most individuals will return to normal, go back to school or work and are fine. It's the 20%, maybe 15 or 20% or so, who have the persisting symptoms. And we think that reflects actual damage, irreversible damage to the brain. It doesn't mean they can't recover, but there is actually damage to the brain network. In the Havana cohort, what we saw may be very skewed, but we did not hear about a lot of other people who had those kind of just more transitory symptoms. It seemed like most people who complained of having some symptoms had persisting symptoms. Not all, but the majority of the cohort we saw had persisting symptoms. So it may be possible that this type of exposure creates a higher level of concussion-like symptoms than even concussion itself.
The Cuban scientists had their own preliminary report on these individuals as well. What do you make of their findings?
It looks like, they first focused on the audible phenomenon, saying that's not possible to injure somebody's brain. And on that, we were in complete agreement. The other things they kind of brought up are other possibilities that we have to consider. For example, could there be poisoning or an illness? And for those, we have to consider that some of these individuals absolutely felt a directed phenomenon. If they moved out of the way, let's say where they were looking through a window and they moved behind a concrete wall or went into another room, the symptoms would subside. So it does seem like a directional type of phenomenon. And I don't know too many poisons or viruses or bacteria that come and go as you move from place to place. We believe it was something about is a unique exposure. It happened in a cluster of individuals. These individuals uniquely happen to be U.S. government employees stationed in Havana. I could speculate on a lot of things of why that would be, but you know, whether there's an attack or not, that's not really in our purview.
Scientists and neurologists raised the prospect of MPI, mass psychogenic illness, in the study. A more colloquial term for this is mass hysteria. Now, mass hysteria, in theory, occurs when symptoms in one person trigger similar symptoms in others. A group of people may believe they have the same affliction as the affected person simply because they've had a similar exposure as someone else.
It's essentially the placebo effect in reverse.
That's Dr. Robert Bartholomew. He's an expert in medical sociology. We reached him in Auckland, New Zealand, where he works at Botany College. Robert walked me through how MPI could have potentially played a role in the symptoms experienced by those affected in Havana.
Well, MPI centers around a belief. And if you look at this case, they define the initial cluster of cases as being some type of acoustical weapon. That's the U.S. State Department. And the doctor there, the head doctor, assumed that there was some type of acoustical attack and then referred these people to somebody who was a specialist in acoustical weaponry. What's happened is they were then counseled, the new staffers, when they went to Cuba, to be aware that they might be exposed to an acoustical weapon. And so they conditioned them to be on the lookout for these strange sounds. And look, at any given time of the day, I probably might not feel 100%, or I might have problems concentrating, feel fatigued. And at any given time, I could probably hear a sound. And that's what's happened here in Cuba. You go over there, and there's all sorts of ever-present sounds. There's crickets, there's cicadas, there's the mundane hustle and bustle of everyday life. And at some point in the day, you might not feel well. And if you think that that's associated with that sound, because you've been preconditioned to think that, then that's a recipe for mass psychogenic illness.
How do you think this might, if at all, have had any bearing on what happened to these diplomats in Havana?
I really think the number one suspect here is mass psychogenic illness. There have been very similar outbreaks like this in the past associated with sound. In Kokomo, Indiana, in 1999, more than 100 people fell ill and attributed it to an anomalous sound that was happening in the city. In Taos, New Mexico, in the early 1990s, there was a similar event. In Bristol, England, there have been illnesses associated with sounds in the city. This is not a new phenomena.
Going back to my conversation with Douglas for a moment, when we spoke, he also highlighted that it was possible that some people may have unwittingly developed symptoms based on the symptoms they observed in the others around them. He went on to say that there were further tests available to suss out the authenticity of a person's condition. However, for Robert, the study conducted by the Penn Group just doesn't add up.
When you look at the study, the evidence is not there. White matter tract changes are common in everything from dementia to depression to normal aging. The evidence for concussion-like symptoms mimic an array of medical conditions, from neurological conditions, psychiatric conditions. One of the commentaries even noted that neuroimaging data in the study was far from clear. The problem is, I'm seeing headlines trumpeting this study with little or no mention of all these caveats.
Meanwhile, in Cuba, scientists feel they've been given little to no information about the US investigation. Cuban experts are taking issue with both the general findings of the study, as well as allegations from the US State Department that this was some kind of sonic attack on US diplomats.
It would take a stretch of imagination to be able to explain the findings with this kind of, let's say, novel technologies.
Some of these individuals absolutely felt a directed phenomenon. If they moved out of the way, let's say where they were looking through a window and they moved behind a concrete wall or went into another room, the symptoms would subside.
But more on that in a moment. Mm-hmm. Before we kick off again, I wanted to point you in the direction of another podcast here at The Guardian. It's called Brexit Means, and as the name would suggest, attempts to finally find out what exactly Brexit does mean, apart from, of course, Brexit. So if you feel like delving into the nitty-gritty of Britain's exit from the EU, make sure to join John Henley and his experts on The Guardian's Brexit Means. To find out more, head over to theguardian.com/podcasts or search Brexit Means on your favourite podcast app. Welcome back to Science Weekly. I'm Ian Sample. Before the break, we heard from Douglas Smith, a co-author of last week's study into the curious symptoms afflicting a group of US diplomats who were working in Havana. We also heard from medical sociologist Robert Bartholomew, who thinks the Penn Group is missing the mark with its conclusions. Now we turn to one of the scientists involved in the Cuban investigation into the cases.
My name is Mitchell Valdez Sosa. I'm director of the Cuban Center for Neurosciences. I'm a neuroscientist, MD, PhD, and I'm a member of the Cuban Academy of Sciences.
Thank you so much. I asked Mitchell what he thought of the likelihood of a sonic attack.
My first reaction is that a sonic weapon was impossible. And in fact, I consulted with scientists across the world, especially in the U.S., with physicists and neuroscientists. We found it extremely unlikely, and in fact, that it was impossible to conceive a sonic weapon that would produce the kind of symptoms that were being described.
How did you come to investigate these cases?
Well, the Cuban Academy of Sciences was asked by the Cuban government to create an expert committee to try to explain what was happening, because obviously something was worrying the American side and it was going to have consequences for the bilateral relations.
So what did you do?
Well, what we did is study the symptoms and then discuss possible causes. We've received very little collaboration, real information from the American side, only a short note describing in a very vague way disorders that these patients had. So we examined if it was possible for sound under any conditions to produce brain trauma. The physics is impossible. Another part of our team examined residents, people living around the houses where the American diplomats were living, and they did not hear any loud noises. And to produce damage to the ear in the audible range of sound, that's from 20, you know, hertz to 20 kilohertz, you have to have over 90 decibels to go through the walls of a room or of a house. It would have to be much higher than that, and nobody heard anything. We examined infrasound, we examined ultrasound. So that kind of explanation was ruled out simply by seeing the claims made by the American side and looking at the science behind it.
Mitchell's team tested a variety of sounds and visited the sites where the diplomats claimed to have experienced these audible interferences. But do incapacitating sound technologies even exist? Could there have been another type of device that could have caused physical damage to the diplomats?
Yes, but that would require a technology that we're not aware of. And I think it would have been very difficult to target a large number of people with a novel technology. And, you know, these diplomats lived in highly restricted areas in the city, and the noises they reported were taking place in their homes. I think that's very unlikely. There's two problems here. We have little evidence, no medical, detailed medical reports, no information. And the second thing is that the number of people supposedly involved has grown, and we think that a large part of the people that have reported some sort of symptom, it's a case of massive psychogenic disorder, that they panicked because they thought they were under attack. And if you look at the timeline of the reports of the cases started increasing in number after they were officially, from what we've read in the press, they received official notice from their governments or from their ambassadors that something was supposedly happening. It's very difficult to clarify all the cases, but we're convinced because of the symptoms described that they don't really have any kind of brain damage.
So do you think then that a good deal of the symptoms that were reported, a good deal of these cases could be explained through some kind of psychological route rather than a direct effect.
We think so. Not all the cases. There could be some people ill, but at one moment, some people in the Canadian embassy also started reporting symptoms. The Canadians started reporting the symptoms after they learned of the supposed attacks, the idea of the attacks in the U.S. embassy. Many of the symptoms, like feeling dizzy, not being able to sleep, having trouble concentrating, are very consistent with anxiety and with some sort of psychogenic disorder.
What about the cases which I think you're acknowledging where they may actually have some kind of brain change that's happened as a result of whatever this incident was?
The evidence for some sort of damage is, in some cases, is a very small group. And that damage could be explained by other causes, not by an attack. And in fact, something I'd like to point out is that this publication was accompanied by an editorial by the journal. And the editorial points out many other explanations that have to be considered. When you examine all the evidence, it's still not clear how many people were really ill, but it seems to be a small number. And second, there's no evidence of any kind of attack. And it would take a stretch of imagination to be able to explain the findings with this kind of, let's say, novel technologies. There are other explanations that have to be explored first.
What do you think this might do to U.S.-Cuba relations?
It's already harmed Cuba-U.S. relations. Now, since the staff at the embassy is at a minimum, people that want to go to the U.S. to visit their family members or want to go, let's say, for scientific exchange, they can't get a visa. They have to go to another country. So this has essentially damaged the normalization of relationships that began during Obama's government. And obviously, it's being politicized. The problem is something did happen. The diplomats got scared. But I think other people are using this to roll back, to try to push for the rolling back of the relationships that had started to blossom during Obama's presidency.
It's a complex situation where science can easily become entwined with politics. It's an issue I asked Douglas about, but first I wanted him to respond to the criticisms regarding the objective of the paper and his argument discrediting the theory of MPI. The first issue that was raised was this one that in the objective of your JAMA paper that you refer to the existence of an energy source as if that's kind of proven.
So the concept of this being an energy source is really our best guess because we can't think of anything else, but it's absolutely not proven yet. So I would agree with him on that side.
So this concern that the explanation or the potential for some of this or all of this to be down to some sort of mass psychogenic effect was disfavored by your team because you're convinced these guys aren't putting it on, that they're not malingerers, that they're really keen to get back to work. And that was the concern over that being used to dismiss the psychological explanation.
Yeah, that's only a singular point, and perhaps that can be debated, but more importantly is the length of time that this persisted. You wouldn't see this over, you know, many, many months if it were kind of like this mass hysteria type of effect. You also wouldn't see it in people who are separated populations. This is a rather complex constellation of symptoms. And yet people who were completely out of contact with each other displayed the very similar type of findings one to the next. So that really, to us, speaks against it. And then finally, because the symptoms are so complex and so specific, like persisting concussion symptoms, individuals, it's not just like, you feel like you have a sore throat or some kind of disease. This would be that you'd have to go and actually research persistent concussion symptoms, practice them, go before a series of experts, one after the other, and convince them that you have these constellation of symptoms. And that includes some tests that can identify malingering or, you know, even if somebody isn't deliberately trying to fake it, but that these tests are designed to identify whether this is a real symptom or not.
And concern about whether the white matter tract findings really amounted to that much. And then the suggestion that this cluster of symptoms that you see could be caused by just a range of other different sort of disparate medical conditions.
Well, I mean, that is an important point. And so could this be something else? The white matter tract changes we were describing were not impressive to us either, and they were similar to what you might see in that same age control group. Therefore, we are looking for more very tangible findings, where we're going to use advanced neuroimaging to identify something specific. So in addition to just the clinical exam, this will give us evidence or not if there are changes in the white matter. And as I mentioned before, just like in concussion, we suspect that this is a network disorder. And if so, that would typically show up in the connectivity of the network in the brain using these advanced techniques.
As for the politicization of the case regarding the U.S. diplomats,
nobody on our team works for the government or has any conflict with anything from the government. In fact, I think most people on the team were skeptical at first and were not expecting to find much here and really had only read news reports. And yet, one after another independently came up with the view that there is something there, that this does appear to be a new syndrome. When we move along in those examinations, we would be open to inviting even the Cubans to come up and discuss with us our findings.
Special thanks this week to Douglas Smith, Mitchell Valdez-Souza, and Robert Bartholomew. If you want to find out more, we'll include a link to the report. If you want to find out more, we'll include a link to the JAMA study on the Guardian website. If you've got any questions, queries, or feedback, please get in touch via our email address, scienceweekly@theguardian.com. I'm Ian Sample. This is Science Weekly.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.